Check out rvf.ca to discover all the activities and contests happening across Canada.
Welcome to the Franco Podcast. Welcome to the 2024 Rendezvous de la Francophonie podcast. I interviewed 8 bilingual or multilingual people for this year's podcast, including Francella Fialos. Francella lives in Halifax and is a program officer and communications director at the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Here is our conversation. You speak several languages. Can you tell me a bit about your linguistic journey?
Sure. I speak English, French, and Spanish. Spanish, I guess, is technically my first language. That's the language I grew up with. My parents spoke to me and my brother and sister in Spanish. And the relationship that I think my siblings have had with Spanish has definitely evolved over the years. We definitely have gone through periods where maybe we would speak more English in response to our parents, or where we would feel more committed and invested in wanting to hone our Spanish speaking skills a little bit, as particularly with my grandmother who only speaks Spanish. So I understand Spanish perfectly well, and then go through moments where I speak a little bit more at home, depending on the content. And if it's like really delicate stuff, like usually I'll try to express myself in English with my mom. Yeah. But I also speak French, and that's just being from Ottawa, a bilingual city, very easy to access French education. I did French immersion all throughout school, and then didn't speak a lot of French throughout university, which I really regret. But when I moved to Halifax in 2016, I was starting to speak again through classes at the Alliance Française. And then before I knew it, I was moving to Montreal, and I lived there for 4 years where I was speaking French pretty regularly and really made an effort to increase my abilities in French through working with a tutor twice a week. So I would say now I'm at a point where I'm fairly proficient in French. Like, again, I think there are always instances in which it's harder to express yourself when you're talking about technical subject matter or just delicate subject matter where nuance is very key. But I do feel very comfortable having conversations in French, and I really do appreciate the ability to speak in somebody's first language, especially if they represent a radio station. I think it's really important to highlight that kind of communication as now a representative of the Community Radio Fund of Canada. And of course, English is probably my language that I'm most comfortable with. I think maybe 98% of my interactions every day I speak in English. And I would say that's the language that I think in. So my internal monologue is in English. And I usually, if I'm stuck in French or stuck in Spanish, it's usually like a moment where I'm translating from English.
When you talk about Spanish, is it a particular type of Spanish?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because there are a lot of regional differences, as many people will point out. Spanish from Spain sounds very different than Spanish from Mexico, and that sounds very different from Spanish in Argentina. For me, my parents are from Nicaragua, so that's right in Central America. And I think there are a lot of linguistic similarities between Spanish spoken in Nicaragua and El Salvador and Costa Rica, since they're pretty close to each other geographically. There are some differences between the Spanish spoken in Nicaragua and Mexico, for instance. I remember in trying to get better at my Spanish, I was watching The Simpsons in Spanish, and there were just certain things where if I would repeat back, my mom would be like, "Oh no, we don't say that. That's, you just say, only people in Mexico say that. That's not, we don't say that." I don't know if that there is a specific term to describe the specific Spanish that we speak at home, but yeah, my parents are from Nicaragua, and I think the linguistic subtleties definitely come up every now and then.
And in terms of the French that you've learned, what I learned in school in French, was what they called Parisian French. That was in the 70s, so they might call it something else now. But you've also lived in Quebec, so you also maybe have experience with a couple different versions.
Yeah, for sure. So I think growing up in Ottawa, the French that we learned was definitely more in line with Quebecois and Franco-Ontarian French. We would definitely take some time to learn like the Quebecois version of certain words, and then maybe we would spend time learning that there's actually a different word in France French. Mm-hmm. But this is how Quebecois say this term. And then, of course, going to Quebec and living in Montreal, fully immersed in Quebecois culture and art and language. So then I picked up even more slang and regional differences between that and French spoken in France. But when I was at the Alliance Française, it was definitely Parisian French that we learned there, with a Parisian accent as well. But I would say the French that I speak at my work at the fund, or if I'm speaking to anybody who speaks French here, even in Nova Scotia where I live, I would say it probably sounds more like Quebecois French.
So yeah, so how about the Acadian communities in your area?
Yeah, that's really interesting that you bring up, because 2 or 3 weeks ago, I visited the Francophone station in Halifax, which obviously serves and caters to the Acadian communities in Nova Scotia. So it was great to hear that accent. I really enjoy the Acadian accent and the linguistic differences in Acadian French. A lot of people do mistake it for being too close to English, but I really appreciate that kind of linguistic variety in French, especially as somebody who is learning French and was kind of developing my own accent, my own constructions and phrases. It was just heartening to know that there are different ways in which French was spoken.
And I'm assuming that being, I guess, trilingual, because you don't have any other languages up your sleeve, right? There's basically just...
No, basically that. There was a time where I was trying to learn Polish because I thought it sounded really pretty. Yeah. And my partner is actually Polish, but he doesn't speak any. But yeah, I was trying to do that, but those three, I would say.
Those are the three. So do you find that that gives you access to books, movies, music in a different way than somebody that was, say, unilingual would have?
Yeah, that's really interesting. With music, like I would probably push back on anybody who says that they couldn't appreciate certain music because it's not sung in the language that they speak. Like, I would certainly push back on that. I would say that there's lots of ways in which you could appreciate music not sung in your native language. And even lots of music that's instrumental or features the voice used in a very interesting way, like almost more as a texture. But when it comes to appreciating films or literature, I would say, having lived in Quebec, there was just a huge culture over there of comic books or bande dessinée, and I thought it was great to not only learn French through reading bande dessinée and getting that additional resource of like illustrations to help contextualize certain scenes, especially when like it's mostly a dialogue heavy passage where people are using a lot of slang that you can't easily look up in a dictionary. And also just to like gain a greater insight into a literary culture that's more heavy in Quebec than anywhere else in the country. I hadn't really noticed bande dessinée or bande dessinée culture when I lived in Ottawa or when I lived in Halifax, but it was basically everywhere when I lived in Montreal. So that was one thing that I would say, that like having an interest or enthusiasm in learning French, and specifically Quebecois French, kind of lend itself naturally to wanting to be interested in this specific style of literature and written component, mixing illustrations as well. And I would always recommend that too for anybody interested in learning French, to read more bande dessinée, because fun, enjoyable, easy. The illustrations can help contextualize, really great for a beginner, and showing an interest in the actual culture, which certainly helps in language learning, I find.
Are there things that you love about being bilingual, and are there things that you find might be difficult about it?
Things that I love about being trilingual, just the ability that I could speak to somebody in their native language. I definitely had run into some moments in Montreal where somebody needed help, but it seemed like they could only speak Spanish. So I was just grateful that I was able to communicate with them and help them get where they needed to go or something. Mm-hmm. And then in French, obviously, to show that interest and commitment in wanting to immerse yourself in the culture and being able to cross those divides. And just have like another tool in your tool belt, so to speak. When you learn French in Ontario, particularly, at least that's what I'm most familiar with and have been exposed to, sometimes it can seem like a chore, unfortunately. If only we could have a different approach to language learning in this country, where like learning French could actually be so useful and so fun and could help you with so much opportunity, then I think people would have a different approach to it. But because it's like something that you have to do, and it's like always in this boring way with using cahiers and not, and like focusing on conjugation and grammar and how the grammar is so hard. I think too, even in Quebec, like there is a culture of wanting to encourage people who come to Quebec to learn French, but really emphasizing that it can be fun. You know, it doesn't have to be a chore. It doesn't have to be like that weird guilty obligation you have to the Duolingo bird who pops up
That's
on your
me.
phone every day. Yeah, like it can really be fun just through like an immersion of culture and understanding and appreciating the culture.
Do you think having learned several languages at a young age has helped you to be good with languages?
I don't know if I would say I'm good at languages. I would just say that I've spent now a lot of time thinking about learning language and that kind of commitment and the frustration you can feel at times in learning a language. When you just feel like impotent or incompetent because you're not expressing yourself how you normally would express if it was your native language, I've definitely felt that numerous times. I would usually tell people like the only way out is through. Like you just have to keep going, even though it's hard and humbling and frustrating. You'll get there. And I think too, to always go from like English to French or English to Spanish or English to any other language, like it's really difficult. English is really not like any other language out there. And I always share with people what my dad once told me when he was learning English from Spanish. He said that English was not that hard to learn because you can say a lot in very little. And that's not the case with Spanish, and that's certainly not the case in French. Like, you really have to expand and be very verbose when you explain something specific, but that's not necessarily always the case in English. He said that the hardest thing was just the pronunciation, but in terms of construction, the things you can get away with in saying very little was great.
Did your dad learn English in Nicaragua or in Canada or somewhere?
Yeah, both my parents learned English when they arrived in Canada. So they did like the classic English learning when they arrived here as new immigrants, and then they also just like immersed themselves in the culture.
So you ended up in French immersion. So was that maybe a conscious choice on their part, or maybe that was something you wanted?
I think I don't even know how that happened per se. It was just like French was around, and I think like I just would take the French immersion option. Because like that's what I wanted to do. I don't know. It was just like I don't know how French immersion was always treated in schools. Like sometimes it's like kind of revered as like this is like for the smart kids, or it's like for, you know, kids who are already speaking multiple languages. I feel like it varies based on the different experiences I hear from people, but like yeah, I don't think there was like a conscious effort on my part, and certainly not on my parents' part, to be like, you need to learn French. Although I do think about like with my own children, like how would I ensure that they get enough Spanish? Because like I said, I mostly speak English and think in English. So like, how would I ensure that they are engaging with Spanish and can speak Spanish and understand Spanish? And then also like, how can I ensure that they speak French? Because I can see the opportunities that open up when you have French. How could I make sure that they are actually like completely fluent and they never have to think about the Duolingo bird and trying to get a job.
Is there a language you feel is home-like to you?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I definitely feel most emotionally provoked by Spanish because like I could easily be transported to my family and home and specific instances in which Spanish was spoken, either like in good and bad ways. In terms of comfort and familiarity, like I think English has been my home base, so to speak. And I feel like a lot of joy recently in trying to just read more literature and read more poetry, for example, and seeing how the English language could be used in very unpredictable ways.
You've mentioned your community radio experience a little bit. Do you want to give us the short version of your experience in the sector?
For sure. So I am the program officer for the Local Journalism Initiative at the Community Radio Fund of Canada. And I also do the communications work for the CRFC. Before that, I was the station manager of CJLO 1690 AM, which is the radio station based at Concordia University in Montreal. And before that, I was the program director at CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax, Nova Scotia, which is the university station at Dalhousie. And I got my start when I was a journalism student at Carleton University, and I volunteered at CKCU.
Definitely. And the NCRA as well, I guess.
Sat on the board at the NCRA and I worked at the NCRA for a bit. Yeah, that's a little bit about my journey in campus community radio.
That was my conversation with Francella Fialos, who lives in Halifax, Nova Scotia. You've been listening to the 2024 Rendezvous de la Francophonie podcast, hosted and produced by Catherine Fisher. The podcast celebrates March, the month of the Francophonie, and it was made possible by the Dialogue Foundation, which has a mission to engage in a sustainable dialogue within the Francophonie and with all of Canada's diversity. This year's Rendezvous de la Francophonie partners and funders include the Government of Canada, the Linguistic Portal of Canada, the National Film Board, Air Canada, La Fédération de la Jeunesse Canadienne-Française, NAV Canada, and many other groups, including the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
What's up, Montreal? It's your boy Freddie V, representing Eclipse and the Community Vibe Collective. Yo, just bigging up your local community radio station, Montreal's only 90.3 FM, CKUT.
Êtes-vous locataire à Montréal? Avez-vous des questions sur vos droits? Votre comité logement peut vous aider. Pour trouver le comité logement pour votre quartier ou pour plus de ressources, visitez le www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Welcome to the Franco Podcast.
Welcome to the 2024 Rendezvous de la Francophonie podcast. There are many good reasons to learn a second, third, or fourth language. It can positively affect our cognitive abilities, improve our attention and task switching capacities, and slow mental decline as we age. It's even been said that to have another language is to possess a second soul. I interviewed eight bilingual or multilingual people for this year's Rendezvous de la Francophonie podcast, including Ness Benamran. Ness lives in the West Kootenay region of BC, but has roots in France, England, and Cyprus, and familial connections to Mauritius. He is a senior manager at a BC nonprofit and a former volunteer programmer and board member at Kootenay Co-op Radio in Nelson. Ness plays drums with a four-piece alt-soul group called Penny Shades. In our conversation, we discussed his shifting connections to language and home, learning and relearning languages, and the difficulty of keeping connected with his languages while living in a primarily English-speaking area. Here is our conversation. You speak several languages. Can you tell me about your linguistic journey?
Well, I was born in France. So the first language I spoke was French. And then my mom and I left France when I was 3 years old and moved to the UK. That's where my mom is originally from. She was born in Mauritius, but raised in London. I learned English when we moved to the UK and forgot my French. My mom says that I rejected speaking French because I was outed in school a lot for, kindergarten for being the French kid. And then we met my dad, my stepfather, who I call my dad, after all these years. And he was also raised in London, but he's Greek Cypriot. So we lived with him for 2-3 years in London. And then we all moved to Cyprus. And that's where I spent most of my childhood. I didn't leave Cyprus until after high school. And in Cyprus, I went to public school there and grew up speaking Greek and spoke English at home with my mom, spoke Greek and a bit of English with my dad, and then Greek, of course, in school and with all my friends. And then when high school was done, I left home. I moved back to France for a few years. And part of the reason was because I wanted to relearn French. And then after France, I started just drifting around, In my 20s, I lived in Australia for a year and backpacked around Asia for a year, and then lived in Barcelona for a year. And I got to learn Spanish there. And then in Barcelona, I met someone from Canada, and that's how my whole getting to know Canada and then move to Canada and then move here to immigrate. That's where that whole journey started. I didn't actually realize I was going to live here. Like, it was kind of a last minute decision when the person who I'd met in Barcelona was moving back, and I was like, well, maybe I'll just come with you and check it out for a few months. Like, at the time, I had no idea it was gonna turn into the place that I would raise my own child, as it turns out. So I've been living in the Kootenays for the last 16 plus years. And yeah, this is definitely the longest I've been in one place at any point in my life, and also where I haven't had the chance to use any of the languages that I've spoke throughout my life before moving here, which has made all of them really rusty.
Actually, I have a question about Cyprus for you. Or what are the common languages in Cyprus?
Cyprus has three official languages. When it gained independence from the British in 1960, the government that was set up was made up of Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots, and chose to have English as a third official language. It's quite common for Cypriots to speak English. A huge percentage of the economy also relies on tourism, so there's a lot of interaction with English-speaking folks. But the other two languages, Greek and Turkish, tend to be somewhat segregated. Turkish Cypriots that live in the and Greek is spoken predominantly in the south.
So you didn't have an opportunity to learn Turkish, for example.
No. And in fact, because of centuries-long conflict between Turkish people and Greek folks, there's no encouragement to engage with, Turkish culture at all in the Greek side of Cyprus.
You obviously had to learn new languages really quickly as a child. Did you have strategies that helped you to do that?
I didn't have any strategies myself. I know that my parents had a strategy, which was pretty simple and effective, as it turns out. And that was to just throw me right into public school, like right into the pool, so to speak, so I could be completely immersed in the language that I was trying to learn. And like, looking back, I guess it makes sense. First, when I was 4 years old, and then when I was six, when we moved to Cyprus. But I have to admit, it definitely made for a challenging first couple years, both in the UK and then in Cyprus. I was old enough to have memories from when we moved to Cyprus, and I remember being in school and having the feeling of kind of like being in a inside a foreign movie. Like, your life is happening around you, but you don't understand what people are saying. And this went on for like a whole year that I was in first year of elementary school. I have one memory of being in class. There was maybe 20 of us, 20 kids in class, and the teacher was up front delivering the lesson, and it was just another day of me having no idea what was being said around me. And I just got up from my desk, and it wasn't recess. I just went out into the playground because it didn't make any sense to just be sitting at this desk not knowing what was being said. So I just got up and went to play, and my teacher just let me go outside, and I was on the swings all by myself while everybody else was in class. And yeah, just having that feeling of, well, I have no idea what is going on around me. And that happened for a full year. Just everything was weird and foreign, from school to, I didn't really have any friends yet because, we couldn't talk. I didn't really start learning Greek until my family moved from the city to a small town in the mountains. The school was much, much smaller. Like actually, it wasn't a town, it was a village. So the school was much smaller, way fewer kids in class. And again, I was the foreign kid that didn't speak any Greek. And my teacher took interest slash pity, I guess, on me and would stay with me after school and go through the material of the day over again and get me to learn Greek and start learning the words. And by that point, I had been there for a year and a half, coming up to 2 years, and some stuff was sticking. And with that additional attention that my teacher was giving me, that's when I started really learning the language.
Did you start to speak Greek at home then as you learned it?
I did with my dad's. My dad's relationship to Greek was also interesting. So he was born in Cyprus and they moved to the UK when he was 5 years old. So he spoke Greek when he moved to Cyprus, but grew up speaking English. So then when we moved back to Cyprus when he was in his mid-30s, his Greek wasn't really strong, not like someone who had grown up in Cyprus or even gone to school in Cyprus. So even though in those first 2 years, like he helped me along my learning of the language, because I was, actually growing up in the country and going to school, pretty soon my language skills far surpassed my dad's. And his reading and writing in Greek was actually pretty poor. Like he could speak it, of course, and he got back into it once we moved back, but it wasn't, how shall I say this? It wasn't, educated Greek. It was just conversational Greek. And as a little side note, I keep saying Greek, but in Cyprus they speak a very distinct dialect. Cypriot is, it's different enough from mainstream Greek that the really heavy dialects that's spoken in villages can be different enough from Greek and use different vocabulary and slang and words that a person from mainland Greece wouldn't understand what's being said. And it's interesting growing up in Cyprus because in schools you're taught proper Greek, but speaking to folks like even outside during recess, like you switch to Cypriot dialect. And it sounds like an exaggeration, but it's not. It's different enough that it could almost be its own language. And in fact, when I was growing up in Cyprus, there was a bit of a movement brewing that was advocating for Greek Cypriot to be recognized as its own language. I remember the main argument against it was that because it didn't have its own form of writing that didn't just borrow from regular Greek, that that was the one catch that was making folks opposed to considering it its own language rather than a dialect.
Do you think speaking several languages may have opened you to new ideas and made you a more creative person?
That is, yeah, that's such a good question, Catherine. I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think one thing that happens with speaking different languages is definitely, yes, being exposed to different ideas and worldviews, even from how the language describes the world. You kind of get to see that there are different lenses to look through to understand how we navigate through this life, not to get too philosophical, but there's a lot of poetry and imagery and how sentences and words are put together in Greek. And I know English often gets a bad rep of not being as rich and poetic as, maybe some of the romantic languages, which I don't fully agree with, but Greek definitely does have a very poetic way of putting words and sentences together, including when, including for, swearing and describing things in a negative way. It can be very creative that way. So I find myself finding a lot more satisfaction in expressing anger, frustration, and swearing in Greek than any other language.
What do you love about being multilingual, and do you find anything difficult about it?
I love the fact that it allows me to relate perhaps more easily to folks that also speak those languages. And that relational piece that I'm talking about also extends to having a lot of understanding for the feeling of needing to navigate in a country that isn't speaking your native tongue. So in my line of work, I've worked in nonprofit that supports folks to find work. And when newcomers and migrants, some of the folks that we support, there's been a lot of satisfaction in having an understanding for what that feels like, needing to, set up your life and find work and build a social network without relying on the comfort and competency of doing that in your native tongue.
So, anything tough about it?
You know, what's tough is realizing how much of the languages I've lost without the opportunity to practice them. And Greek is one that definitely breaks my heart the most. When I moved away from Cyprus after going to school there, and I excelled in school in Cyprus. I was an avid reader, and I loved history and Greek in the way that we learn, English and literature in schools here. I spoke Greek really, really well. I had a real strong command of the language. I don't mean to sound big-headed. I'm just contrasting it against today, where I can understand it perfectly, but to just switch into speaking Greek, I would need to be immersed in it for a little while first. It just doesn't roll off the tongue. And every now and then, I'll force myself to think in Greek. Like, how would I? And the words just don't come to me. And when I was moving away from Cyprus, I remember having these conversations where folks said, if you don't practice the language, you'll forget it. And at the time, because of being so fluent in Greek, I just didn't realize that was a reality, that was a possibility. Same with French and Spanish. The area we live in just doesn't provide the opportunities to speak unless you really go out looking for it. Like, it's an English-speaking part of the world predominantly, So yeah, that's difficult, kind of assessing my current situation and realizing how much of that skill I've lost, and how much work and intention it would take for me to get back to the level that I was at one point in my life.
Do you think about it in terms of passing languages on to your child?
That's a really bang on point. Yeah, that is part of the sadness. Bennett, that's my daughter's name. I do speak French to her and a few Greek words here and there, but it's not the same as when you're, feeling confident and fluent in it. Like, it is a little forced. And I mean, we don't speak French or Greek at home, so her mom, for example, has no context of what I'm saying. But yeah, I try to expose her to it as much as I can, but do feel limited in it.
So, in a recent episode of the North American Francophone podcast, Claire Marie Brisson used the phrase "a language that feels like home." It sounds like Greek may be your language that feels like home. Is that true?
I would say so, yeah. And more specifically, Cypriot. Especially since it is a dialect that's, very specific to that island. It's not, spoken anywhere else in the world. Like, there's not a huge Cypriot diaspora. It's highly unlikely to run into a person speaking Cypriot. I think I only have in Canada once. I've run into a few Greek folks, but that doesn't really feel like home, like proper Greek, because Greece isn't Cyprus. There's a huge cultural connection, but it's a different country altogether. So one time, at a supermarket, I heard people speaking Cypriot, and Yeah, those words are very well sp spoken, like a language that feels like home. Like it instantly transported me to, and yeah, there was no hesitation to go up to them, and they were just as shocked as I was to run into someone in the Kugnis speaking Cypriot. At the same time, it's a little interesting because the whole concept of home is one that I struggle to pinpoint. I grew up in Cyprus, but I'm not Greek, I'm not Cypriot. I was, the foreign kids, my whole life in Cyprus, even though I was, I went to school there and all my friends were Cypriots. Like no one's called Ness in Cyprus, everyone's called Andreas and Konstantinos and what have you know what I mean? So the name and how I look, as soon as folks knew, met my mother, like it was clear that, oh, you're not native born to Cyprus. So although it Cypriot feels like home in the sense of that's where I spent my childhood, not so much that's where I'm from, with that sense of real belonging. And the UK doesn't feel like home, France doesn't feel like home, Canada feels like home, but in the way of how I imagine a lot of immigrants, feel like this is my new home, my chosen home where I've now built roots. But yeah, it's almost a daily experience that I'm kind of reminded that, oh yeah, I didn't start my life here. People will bring up TV shows that everyone grew up with, and I'm like, no, I didn't grow up with that, So yeah, the whole idea of where is home is still a question mark for me. So there's definitely a very comforting familiarity with hearing Cypriot, but insofar as I consider it home in that full wholesome sense, there's still like something lacking there.
That was my conversation with Ness Ben-Amran, who lives in the West Kootenay region of British Columbia. You have been listening to the 2024 Rendezvous de la Francophonie podcast, hosted and produced by Catherine Fisher. The podcast celebrates March, the month of the Francophonie, and it was made possible by the Dialogue Foundation, which has a mission to engage and sustain dialogue within the Francophonie and with all of Canada's diversity. This year's Rendezvous de la Francophonie partners and funders include the Government of Canada, the Linguistic Portal of Canada, the National Film Board, Air Canada, La Fédération de Jeunesse Canadienne Française, NAB Canada, and many other groups, including the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
Heavy Trip and CKUT present. An evening with Revenge International recording artists, Horse Lords and Colbert. A no Grammy double whammy, Chock a Block with Sonic Tomfoolery. Live at Sotrania on Saturday, March 16th. Tickets on sale now. For more information, visit www.google.com.
This is Braja Wallman on behalf of the Montreal Jazz Explosion. You're listening to CKUT.
To the Franco podcast.
Welcome to the 2024 Rendezvous de la Francophonie podcast. There are many good reasons to learn a second, third, fourth language. It can positively affect our cognitive abilities, improve our attention and task switching capacities, and slow mental decline as we age. It's even been said to have another language is to possess a second soul. I interviewed 8 bilingual or multilingual people for the 2024 Rendezvous de la Francophonie podcast, including Dr. Claire Marie Brisson. Dr. Brisson is a Franco-Michigander with roots in Metro Detroit and familial connections to Quebec. She's currently the preceptor in French at Harvard University and is the founder and host of the North American Francophone podcast. In our conversation, we discussed her family connections and deep love of language. I learned a little bit about Franco-American history, and we talked about why learning about language is so important. Here's our conversation. Claire Marie, you speak several languages. Can you tell us about your linguistic journey?
Yes, I'd love to. So French is really, I would say, entangled with English. And both languages were spoken at home. So I would say that I grew up in a bilingual environment at home. And I grew up right on the border with Canada. So that also has something to do with my experience having grown up in Michigan. I also speak German. That was my minor in college. And I spoke that at home as well a bit because we had a family connection to Alsace in France. And my great-grandmother spoke German as her first language. So that was carried on down the family line. I speak a little bit of Italian and I read Latin. I started to try to learn ancient Greek. And I'm in the process of learning the Irish language, so Gaelic, as many people would call it, because my mom had part of her family go from Brittany and Normandy in France to Ireland for some time. And I feel a very special connection to that language. I have some proficiency in Arabic because I grew up in Dearborn, Michigan, where Arabic signage is all through the city. And I know at least how to order a coffee and a pastry and to have a little bit of a chit chat with a friend, but nothing too complex. And I do understand some Spanish, and I can read Russian, but it's really not there. So I live a polyglot experience. I try to learn as much as I can. I know a phrase here and there from other languages, but languages really just revolve around my life, and I love them.
So when did you discover that you loved languages?
I think it was because of where I grew up. I mean, it's really on the border of Canada and the United States where you have so many communities of languages, so many people who are speaking different languages at home, where you see that signage in my hometown, where you see it in Arabic, where you see it in Spanish. I knew that there was something going on that was beyond just life in English here in the United States and in Canada. And I said, okay, what does that mean for me? And when I was a kid, I used to go to the library and I'd check out books to learn languages. I would check out the sort of the Rosetta Stones out of the library and bring them home. And soon the librarians got to know me and they said, wait a minute, you were here a couple weeks ago and you were checking out that thing on Hindi and now you're checking out Japanese. What are you doing? I just had so much interest in language and in the world around me. And even as a child, that was the case. I was the one poring over the illustrated encyclopedias and wanting to know where different people lived, how they lived, what they spoke, how they communicated with one another, and what was important to them.
Were either of your parents like that?
My dad, I think, my mom and my dad really was interested in languages more in the applied sense. He was interested in logic and language, Aristotelian logic, a lot of logical and semiotic ways of using language. So a little bit more of the linguistic side of language. My mom had a dream as a child to be an interpreter for the UN. And she always thought about that. She loved it. She thought it was a great thing to be able to listen to someone and immediately translate. And unfortunately, that never became her ultimate reality. But it was something in her life that motivated her and encouraged her to really mm-hmm. translate experiences. She worked in healthcare, and she often would tell people what was going on with them and translate that into a narrative, into clear language for them. And my grandfather was a translator for the Canadian Army and eventually worked with the American Army as a Canadian. So there was a lot of language going on in my family, too.
Maybe turning for a minute to Franco-American history, for listeners that may be unfamiliar with that, maybe that term and that history, would you mind sketching out a few details for us?
Certainly. So there were a lot of Francophones who came across the border, primarily from Quebec into the United States. And this started really in the 1840s, where there's an industrial revolution in the United States, and many Francophones from Canada just didn't have the same industrial capacity. And so they started coming to the United States because, as they said in French, on a trouvé du pain. So we found bread. We found bread on this side of the border. And so they'd write letters back home, and that would encourage other Francophones to come here. Actually, around 1 million French Canadians came across the border to New England from between 1840 and 1930. And of course, that stops because of the Great Depression. So that traditionally is the term we use. Franco-American is somebody who came across the border that way. But there are plenty of Francophones in the United States, and there really is a debate between the use of Francophone, Franco-American, and how to express our identity here in the United States. So there were Francophones who already lived in places like New York, Washington, D.C., Savannah, Georgia, either by choice or because they were fleeing different parts of North America, like Acadia. And there's also Francophones in Louisiana who came directly either from France or from Acadia. So then there's others like me, the Francophones of the Midwest, who have connections to Canada, who have connections even to New England. And then the Francophones of Western United States and Western Canada, of course, that expansion moved westwards. And we know definitely the history in Manitoba and British Columbia and Alberta. We know that history also in the foundation of Oregon. The founder of Oregon was a Métis person who spoke French as well as First Nations languages. So this is really the story of North America, but oftentimes we reduce that story to a couple of regions and we say, oh, well, New England historically had Francophones, and it's always a past tense, or, oh, Louisiana had Francophones, but it really is a present tense and a future tense.
Thank you for bringing so many threads together in that. I wasn't clear from my reading if Franco-Americans referred to a particular group of Americans that spoke French or the general thing. And it sounds like that there's some confusion there in general about it.
Yeah, sure. And especially I think there's pride in a good way. There's pride in the community here now I live in New England, and there's pride within that community of that experience where people came across the border and they established themselves in what they called Little Canadas here. So definitely they want to protect that term and they want to protect that history. But at the same time, there are Francophones from sea to sea.
You started your podcast in part because you wanted people to know more about this history. Can you tell me some of the subjects you've touched on so far?
Absolutely. I've talked about everything from cuisine to poetry to cultural activism and a little bit in between. I tried to bring people on the podcast and say, so what links you to the Francophonie? What really brought you within your community to do what you do? And I've had interesting stories where, for example, Joseph Dunn, who's very well known in the community in Louisiana, Joseph Dunn talked about how he speaks a France-style French because his family was directly from France. And at the same time, he recognizes the different forms and variations of French that exist in Louisiana. And we talked about that. My first episode, I talked about how I explored a very old cookbook that came from France to Canada. And it was really the first Francophone cookbook or way to explore the culinary environment here in North America, what was available, what was possible. And by way of language, really seeing the environment and where people were with that. I look at history. For example, I talk about the first work of African-American literature was published in French. It's by Victor Séjour. And that was published in Paris, but Victor Séjour was living in Louisiana. So just another example. And I've also invited authors on the podcast, like Pierre Lavoie, who is a Quebecois author who had never translated his work into English, but for the first time, he's there talking about what he did. And he talks about celebrities in New England.
I listened to that. It was a great episode.
A lot of fun, actually.
Yeah.
Because I remember just before we recorded, he said, you know, I haven't translated my book. I haven't been able to do this. And now here I am in English. And I said, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. You know, that's exactly what I want to do with this podcast. And what I'm going to be doing with more episodes is to bring people into conversation with the English-speaking community.
Well, it's interesting because I mean, I consider myself to be fairly well read, but I didn't know, for example, that Jack Kerouac had a Franco-American background.
It's funny because there's a certain level of, you know, having that experience, knowing that you're a Francophone. He grew up all the way until the age of 6. He was speaking French only at home. And then there's the other experience where you say, wait a minute. Okay, so I am Francophone, but I want to share myself with the rest of the world. And especially in the past, French was a language that if you were not publishing, say, for example, in France, maybe it wasn't really looked upon as authentic as much. And that's the sad part about it, is that someone like Kerouac has to write in English and writes in English because there's an authenticity to his American experience if it's told in English. There's also an interesting interview between Kerouac and an interviewer from Radio Canada, where he's sitting in front of a group of people in Montreal, I believe, and the audience is looking at him, and they're all so curious. Why is this man from Massachusetts, from Lowell, Massachusetts, speaking French? And what an interesting accent he has. What a joual this guy has. And they start giggling. I imagine not out of disrespect, but out of just curiosity. Wow, I can't believe that this guy is actually continuing to speak French and speaks in such a way and possibly speaks in such a historic or regional way. And it's that interesting transformation where we think about language as being translated across cultural barriers, across geographies, and the personal interactions we have with the language. I think it's just fascinating.
Thank you for doing the podcast. I understand you have a book coming out as well. Do you want to let us know a little bit about what that's going to be about?
Sure. So I'm looking at identity. As we started this discussion, we talked a little bit about that term Franco-American. And I think a lot of people get confused or maybe historically connected to that term and say, okay, well, that was just a group of people who came from primarily Quebec into the United States. But if we look at it, as I mentioned, I love languages. So if we take the tense and we make it present and future, then we can look at what's possible for people who speak French here in North America. And so my book is called Michiganaise, and it might sound like mayonnaise with Michigan, and it should, because mayonnaise is in the style of a region called Mahon. So it was mayonnaise. It was in the style of that region. Well, I'm in the style of Michigan. I grew up in Michigan. So Michiganaise. And I talk about that experience where I was at the confluence between two countries. I was at the intersection of multiple languages. I grew up knowing that my community was interesting and unique and entwined and intertwined within itself and also within all of the people across the world who speak languages that are not connected to one another. Romance languages, not connected to Arabic-based languages, not connected to, I mean, there's so many disconnections and connections in the same space and in the same place. So I really disentangle my experience as a Francophone growing up in Metro Detroit. And I say, well, what is possible for a Francophone in North America today, tomorrow, and beyond? Because there really is, I think, when we think about the community, there's such an attachment to history, which is great. I studied cultural history. I love history. But at the same time, if we don't realize that every moment is living history and we're contributing to history, then we get lost in the facts, but can't think about where we're going next. So that's a lot of what I'm doing in that book. I'm resituating the narrative a little bit, and I'm really excited to share that.
What do you love about being multilingual, and do you find anything difficult about it?
Oh, gosh. Well, one thing I love is that I feel ready to communicate with more people than I would if I were, say, for example, only a Francophone or only an Anglophone. I think that speaking English and speaking French, as an example, are two great languages. And I think that Canada is so fortunate to have English and French as official languages. Here in the United States, we don't have an official language, but I think Canada is so fortunate to have those as official languages because you can speak to so many people. And I think that the reason why I want to continue my learning and my study of languages that either have family connections or don't is that I see the world through a different lens.
And if you think about photography, if you use different lenses, you can zoom close, or you can see far, or you can take pictures of people doing sports and capture them as they're running across a field. The same is true for a language. You can really capture different perspectives and see the world in such an illuminating way if you speak another language. Now, a difficulty with that is really translating in real time. Sometimes I'm thinking in French and then I say something in English and I hear myself and it's a direct translation from French. And I say, oh, interesting, that syntax was not English at all. But sometimes I have both languages used in my head in the same sentence, and then it comes out as a word jumble. But right. I'd rather have that be a problem than not be able to do it at all. So it's a blessing, and sometimes can be a little bit confounding, but it's fine.
I was interested in your one of your podcasts. You said that you your dreams as a child were fragmented in French, English, and German. Do you still have dreams like that?
Yes, absolutely, all the time. And what's interesting is many of those dreams, the German is primarily food and cultural items, you know, things that I feel connected to through that Alsatian heritage, foods that my great-grandmother used to cook and then passed down to my grandfather and passed down to my dad and then passed down to me. And then I have French and then I have English. And sometimes it's interesting, my brain comes up with different languages that I can't understand, and then I'm trying to decipher it through the things I know. So a lot of fun play in my dreams with language. And I wish I could share that too, but you know, that's a personal cinema. Interestingly enough, German has a great word for that. It's Kopfkino. It means Kopf is head, and Kino means cinema. So it's kind of like you create your own movies in your head. And I guess that's what my dreams are.
Well, so you're an educator, you've started a podcast, you're writing a book. Is there anything else you feel like you'd like to do?
I think that the next step is really to get engaged with governments, with schools, with people who are really and truly trying to do the same things, but in different realms. And I've started to do a little bit of that work, but I feel like there's so much more to do. And obviously I'm only one person, but to speak a little bit more with who is learning French? What does learning French look like? What does learning French look like, particularly here in the United States? And I know that sadly we're facing so many cuts of language learning here in the United States. The humanities often are on the chopping block of many high schools or colleges even. And that's very sad to me. And I think dialoguing with school boards and universities and high schools and maybe giving some talks or at least chatting a little bit and saying, you know, here's why languages are important. Here's why French is a gateway to our neighbors to the north in Canada. Here's why French is a gateway to the Francophonie, 88 countries or 88 mm-hmm. member states that speak French. So it's a challenge, it's a battle, but it's something that I'd like to include. And then I also would like to escape a little bit just from being so language-based and really think about what are cultures doing in general? What does it mean to be proud of a language or to study a language or to think about where we are in the world today, since we're so connected, right? We're talking to one another right now across such a distance. And yet it seems like we're in the same room sharing a coffee together. You know, this is the incredible thing about the internet that we often forget. And really thinking and having conversations with communities broadly outside of a similar or shared language and say, what does it mean that we've been connected to one another for 35 plus years using this type of technology? And how can we understand languages combined together, not as so separate as we often have done through linguistics, but where are we going with language? What is communication are on the chopping block of many high schools or colleges even? And that's very sad to me. And I think dialoguing with school boards and universities and high schools and maybe giving some talks or at least chatting a little bit and saying, you know, here's why languages are important. Here's why French is a gateway to our neighbors to the north in Canada. Here's why French is a gateway to the Francophonie, 88 countries or 88 mm-hmm. member states that speak French. So it's a challenge, it's a battle, but it's something that I'd like to include. And then I also would like to escape a little bit just from being so language-based and really think about what are cultures doing in general? What does it mean to be proud of a language or to study a language or to think about?
What's up? This is Kid Koala. You're listening to CKUT in Montreal, 90.3 FM.
Welcome to Gender Reveal, a podcast where we hopefully get a little bit closer to understanding what the hell gender is. I'm your host and resident gender detective, Tuck Woodstock. Hey everyone, hope you've all been hanging in there. Our week of bonus content continues. I have something very special to share with you today. You may have heard about the podcast, The Anti-Trans Hate Machine. It's made by Amara Jones and the team that makes the Trans Lash podcast. This season of The Anti-Trans Hate Machine traces the way that the myth of trans social contagion has gone from a fringe conspiracy to a powerful force in the anti-trans movement, gaining ground within progressive families and mainstream media outlets. The series culminates in a deep dive into the inner workings of the New York Times and how anti-trans bias has become a feature of the paper of record and its culture of silencing those who dare to speak out and hold the New York Times to its own editorial standards. When I first heard rumors that this episode was coming out, I was so excited to hear it, and it really blew me away. I, as someone who thinks about this topic all the